Hello and welcome to the Technically Legal Podcast. This is episode 63 for August 17th, 2010. I'm one of your hosts today. My name is Ben Snitkoff, and with me today we've got
Dominic Rabier
and David O'Brien.
We've got our typical three stories for you. First off, we're going to revisit the Google and Verizon net neutrality pact that we first talked about last week. Second, we're going to talk about a DC Circuit Court of Appeals case that says that police, at least in the District of Columbia, now need to get a warrant before they put any type of 24-hour GPS tracking on a vehicle. And finally, we're going to talk about Discovery Channel and their own very special Shark Week that they are directing at a fan site for the Deadliest Catch. So first off, we're going to talk about the Google and Verizon net neutrality pact. Now, we first talked about this last week when all we had were rumors in the Wall Street Journal and New York Times that Google and Verizon had reached some sort of net neutrality deal. And those rumors tended to imply that there would actually be some sort of monetary agreement between Verizon and Google that was directly violative of the net neutrality principles that we were all familiar with and excited for. Google and Verizon both denied these rumors in kind of cagey ways, and it turns out on Monday they held a press conference in which they announced a, quoting from their document, Verizon-Google legislative framework proposal. And basically what this does is it sets out some things that kind of look like net neutrality, but in some ways aren't, and we'll dive into those a little more. Basically, it says that for a wired broadband service, that's kind of the broadband that you get into your house, any internet provider should be prohibited from engaging in any, quote, undue discrimination against lawful internet conduct, content, which means they can't throttle it or, well, they can't unduly throttle it. A lot of these are still trying to struggle with what all of this means. If they do have any kinds of restrictions, it says that they have to be very transparent and disclose them, but it does provide for reasonable network management services, reasonable network management practices, rather. I guess I'll throw this to the panel before we go through and hit all of the bullet points here. Is there anything that you guys are excited about? Is there anything that you guys are really angry about or disappointed in with these net neutrality guidelines? Dominic?
Well, and the big thing that stands out is they only restrict this to broadband, right?
Right. This only applies to wired broadband and not wireless broadband. So right now it doesn't apply to cell phones. There's the best practices that are now going to be in place at Google and Verizon are that you can throttle, you can prioritize, you can do whatever you want for wireless broadband, which would be 3G and 4G networks. But is that really the thing that we're most worried about here, that this doesn't apply to wireless networks? The agreement specifically leaves open the idea that it could apply in the future, but right now, because the technology is moving forward at such a fast pace, because there's so much constant change in wireless services, we're going to leave that an open question and let Congress and maybe the FCC kind of keep tabs on that and check in every now and then and see if we have to implement some sort of net neutrality here. What really worries me is all of the loopholes that they've written into the wired broadband provisions, that you can't unduly discriminate, that you can have reasonable network management practices, that this doesn't apply to, quote, additional online services, which aren't really defined. It seems like net neutrality is the rule to the exceptions here, that, you know, all of the exceptions that they put in may end up swallowing what was really the core of net neutrality. You know, would it be an undue discrimination to throttle YouTube even a little bit, or is it not? Do we have any guidance here?
And the biggest concern I have about this story is that the FCC is out of the picture. It's, first of all, it's kind of unclear whether the FCC has even has authority, because the DC Circuit, back when Comcast had a net neutrality case, they said that the FCC doesn't have authority in this area. So the fact that carriers can take the FCC out of the picture, make this agreement, restrict it to broadband, potentially not apply to wireless, it's somewhat of a concern in that, do we really want these giant companies who control significant amounts of the internet making this policy? What's to stop them from changing their minds later on, or something of that variety?
Right, and the FCC's role is kind of ambiguous in this. It does say that the FCC will have the ability to impose a fine of up to, it looks like, $2 million for knowingly for knowing violations of these principles. Should the FCC or Congress adopt these principles and then impose them on the companies? But as far as actual ability to create new regulations, it seems like this is, the proposal is kind of thrown out there as, how about you guys take this instead of continuing to fight with the companies here? There are two big companies who are willing to agree with this, and I think what Google and Verizon are trying to do here is say, we'll throw this out there with the hopes of you guys accepting this and just, meeting us halfway, where halfway isn't really halfway at all, but really gives a whole lot of relatively major concessions to the content providers and the broadband providers. But I think your point is taken that the FCC has a substantially lesser role in this than they would otherwise, and this proposal kind of puts onto the legislature the onus of amending and changing the net neutrality rules. And the legislature moves notoriously slowly, and notably much more slowly than regulatory authorities in doing this kind of thing. David, do you have any thoughts or concerns about the proposals, or specifically the FCC's lack of involvement therein?
Well, I do think what Dominic has pointed out here is interesting. When you think about the past and when the FCC has tried to mandate changes, large regulatory changes, there's often been the sentiment that what the FCC does isn't always right. And so I guess along those lines you could say that maybe that the FCC doesn't have the same authority that it might have had, might be a little bit better. But it's really early to tell still in the net neutrality days. The other problems with this agreement seem to be that they don't really define the term lawful content. I don't know if you guys had also caught that, and it doesn't seem to be as detailed as I might have expected it to be, but that's probably what you get when you involve private parties.
Right.
The biggest additional concern I have is the term, like, not just lawful content, but if you read very carefully, they specifically exclude additional differentiated online services from this agreement. And it almost seems like it's kind of net neutrality for the parts of the net that we want neutral, but then these additional differentiated online services, whatever those are, this agreement doesn't apply.
Right. The implication that I was getting from what Google and Verizon were saying after their press conference, they did a little Q&A. And what I understood that to mean is, at least in Google and Verizon's view right now, is that Verizon could also send, say, television down their Fios lines, and they could speed up that as much as they wanted to, because that's an additional service that's not really internet, but it's going over the same pipes. Now, we should mention, and there'll be a link to this proposal in the show notes. It's only 2 pages, and everyone's very concerned because nothing's defined. It's really because it's difficult to define stuff that carefully in 2 pages. But as David mentioned, lawful content, what does that mean? Does that mean that they're going to be able to totally throttle off, or totally cut off, or even throttle down BitTorrent, which, even though most the vast majority of it is infringing, some of it is not? Where's that lawful content line drawn there? What about for other things? Free speech issues. If it's a something that's borderline not free speech, but it's still, a blog, a very inflammatory blog, would that be throttled, or would that be cut off under these? Could it even be cut off under these proposals? There are a lot of very worrying questions that have not been answered by Google or Verizon.
I mean, on the whole, the proposal, I mean, it's a good start, but I guess apart from the FCC not being involved, that really additional, like, I guess the frustrating for me is that they're saying, we want net neutrality, here's a proposal, but we're excluding wireless networks and these additional differentiated services from potentially this agreement. And the whole idea of net neutrality is that it applies to the entire net. Like, it's not net neutrality if you just say, oh, well, it only applies to this part of the internet. The other part of the internet, they get priority service. That's the exact opposite of net neutrality.
Right. In Google's press conference, they kept on referring to the public internet, and these additional undifferentiated services they refer to as the private internet. And I understand that when you're sending television over the same pipes as you're sending internet, that, you know, there are two different parts of it. But even bringing in that term, a private internet, into the parlance is almost, what's the word I'm looking for, Orwellian of Google of all people.
Scary, yeah.
It's also worrisome that they decided to do this all behind closed doors. You know, there were already, I guess, largely behind closed doors, talks between the FCC and most of the major players to try to iron out some net neutrality agreement that everyone could be a part of. Meanwhile, Google and Verizon nip off somewhere, bang out this two-page thing, and throw it up there, and now create a new, you know, I guess, de facto starting place, at least for public conversation, if not the private conversation that the FCC was having, and then rather abruptly stopped once the rumors of the Verizon and Google pact leaked.
What happened to the "Don't Be Evil" company that we once knew as Google?
I don't know. There was also another on this vein of Google being evil. There was another story from the Wall Street Journal that Google is trying to strike a new balance between safeguarding users' privacy and selling user data to enhance ad revenue, and, you know, putting more of that data out there to get better ad results and more click-throughs. I guess "Don't Be Evil" only works until your company is, you know, such a large size that you really have to start being evil to be a good company. That being said, I heard another quote that Google's "Don't Be Evil" must have been trumped by Verizon's "Be Very Evil." Any other thoughts on this story, or do we want to move on?
I'm very interested to see what people's reactions are to this, and maybe to see if this gets developed a little bit further. At least to me, and as I'm reading all of this, I kind of just got a hold of this story this morning, since I was traveling all last week and pretty much off the grid. So what I would like to see is, you know, if there's any further clarification to the suggestions or the proposal or whatever you want to call it that Google and Verizon have come to here, and it, you know, if they develop it any further to hash out some of these defined terms, or if it's just going to stand as is, and both Google and Verizon would like it to stay the way it is.
Right, we certainly haven't heard anything new from Google or Verizon since they announced this plan as to really what these terms mean. But we'll obviously keep an eye on it and report if we hear any more. Dominic, any last thoughts, or do you want to just take it away to the next story?
So our next story comes from the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District Court of Columbia. And basically, there was a case there where we have the FBI. The case is United States versus, I believe, Maynard is how you pronounce it. The FBI planted a GPS tracking device in someone's car while it was on private property, and then they used that device to track where this person went. And the lawsuit was basically, at least this aspect of the lawsuit, was about whether the FBI had a right to do that. Specifically, they did this without a search warrant. Let's say we're going to put Dave in a hypothetical.
Woohoo!
Yeah, it's the U.S. Court of Appeals, sorry, for the District of Columbia, but it's a circuit court. Just to be absolutely clear, this is an appellate court, not a district court. Sorry, the District of Columbia might have, I kind of said it all in a blur. So the FBI puts a tracking device on David's car, and they see where David goes. They see he goes to work. They see he goes home, goes anywhere else. And they didn't have a search warrant for this. And basically, the argument in this case was that this was a violation of the Fourth Amendment in that it was an invasion of privacy. The FBI was saying, no. This is akin to radio-based tracking beepers, like the old-school tracking device. You put a beeper, and then you see where he is using radio. But the court rejected that, saying that because GPS is so much more precise, and it's so much easier to do, and it's not as limited, because radio-based tracking beepers, I believe, expire at some point. Or what's the key difference here between a bumper beeper and a GPS device?
I think the primary difference is that bumper beepers had never been used for such an extended period of time. This was surveillance. It gave a location, I think, every 10 seconds for 24 hours or more. And bumper beepers were previously just used as like a one-off thing.
Right, the guy's getting away. You take your bumper beeper gun, you shoot his bumper, and then you can track him and call in CTU. And so it's a pretty big decision in that basically it doesn't say the FBI can't do this. It just says the FBI is going to need to go get a search warrant if they want to track someone's location every 10 seconds for, say, I think in this case it was for an entire month. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, that's right.
So you can definitely see how the FBI could use, say, tracking 10 or 15 people. They can see when they're in the same location, or at least when their cars are in the same location, if they're tracking the GPS of their cars, or potentially tracking GPS location using their cell phone, which is also a possibility, especially with a lot of the newer cell phones. Apple, for example, it's the iPhone, you can track GPS locations on that.
Yes, what's interesting about this, at least in my view, is that in the previous cases that have dealt with this kind of thing, the Supreme Court and other circuit courts of appeals have found that, rather held, that you don't have any expectation of privacy in where you are out in the public at any given time. And what this case did is said, yes, if somebody's out on the street and they spot you there and they report it, or if a police officer even follows you for a set period of time, like a finite period of time, you don't have a expectation of privacy there. But what you do have an expectation of privacy in is your whereabouts every second of every day for a month, which it's an interesting distinction to draw because it's kind of splitting hairs. You don't have an expectation of privacy for a 4, 8, 12 hour period as to where your location is. But if it's a 24 hour period or a 48, 72, where does that line actually get drawn?
Yeah, but it's almost sort of an argument saying that the entirety is greater than the individual pieces. Like being able to see where someone has been for the entire period of time is much more informative than just these little snippets. I'm not
Right,
sure
and
whether it'll
that's
hold up legally.
right, and that brings me to my next point. But the DC Circuit Court of Appeals made that specific point that they pointed to a few Supreme Court cases which kind of agree with this, but not really, that the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. That there's a you can get more from a wide swath of information from that than you could from each of these individual pieces broken up. My next point was that I believe it is three other circuit courts of appeals have found the other way, that you don't have any reasonable expectation of privacy in your whereabouts 24/7, in light of GPS tracking. And this is interesting because it creates what's called a circuit split. And when there's a circuit split, when some circuit courts of appeals go one way and another circuit court of appeals or maybe a state supreme court goes another way, the Supreme Court is more likely to hear the case. They're more likely to do what's called grant certiorari and let people brief the case and argue in front of the Supreme Court so they can get a final verdict on it. And if you'll permit me another brief digression, while this is going on in the DC Circuit Court of Appeals, Judge Kaczynski, the Chief Justice, I believe, of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals just wrote a very funny and kind of snarky dissent from a case there where the Ninth Circuit said that not only was there no reasonable expectation, not only is warrantless GPS tracking permissible, but it's okay for the police to come onto your property, go up underneath your car in your driveway, and smack the GPS tracker there, that you don't have any reasonable expectation of privacy in the undercarriage of your car, which I think is kind of ridiculous. The majority in that case said something along the lines of, if there had been a fence or a no trespassing sign, maybe this would be different, but there's no evidence of that here. Any neighbor kid could have thrown their car, thrown their ball underneath the car and kind of scurried under and picked it up. David, you haven't. I'm sorry, Dominic, you go.
Which is technically true, but any neighbor kid isn't going to attach a GPS tracking device to the other side of the car.
Right, and Kaczynski made that point too. There's a difference between retrieving a ball and fiddling with things underneath your car.
Well, historically, Ben, this has always been your area of expertise, at least on our website and on the podcast. But it seems to me that courts are still having a very hard time trying to adapt themselves to somewhat new uses of technology. I don't want to call them overly new uses of technology.
Right, and that's fair. I will mention, I think we covered this. An issue related to this in September or October, there is a Massachusetts case that said that agreed essentially with the DC Circuit here. I don't remember whether the Massachusetts case was relying on the federal constitution or the Massachusetts constitution. My guess is that it was the Massachusetts constitution. But in that case, one of the judges said that there was a Fourth Amendment reasonable expectation of privacy in your whereabouts at any given time. And The judge there, however, did not back it up with any citation to law. It was just a bold fact that he stated in a, I think it was a concurring opinion in that case. So it was a little bit of a weird duck that got some press attention, and I'm not entirely sure why. I believe it was on Slashdot, which may explain why it caused whatever kind of kerfluffle it caused.
Well, on the whole, I seem to agree with the concept that if you're going to track somebody for a either infinite amount of time or for a very long amount of time every day, then you've probably got an issue with expectation of privacy rights. The other courts that seem to state, you know, if tracking is much more finite, then it's probably not as much of an issue because you could have easily had somebody, say, tail a person, you know, in a car behind the car. In the suspect's car, and you probably wouldn't need to get a warrant for that, but there's something very invasive about tracking somebody 24/7 for 30 or 31 days.
Yeah, they actually address that situation. They say that the government in this case actually argued that, hey, we could track this guy just by driving around and following him, and we wouldn't need a warrant for that. So why are you saying that it's any different if we use technology? And the way the court basically got around this is they said, wait a second, that's the wrong question. The right question is whether or not there's a reasonable expectation of privacy in your location at all times, and the GPS specifically exposes that information. Whereas someone following you around, first of all, the guy's probably going to notice, hey, this car has been driving after me for the last week. But second of all, it's not the same sort of exposition of the information.
Yeah, it's not like that it's automatically being beamed to headquarters.
Yeah.
In the case of 24-hour surveillance, somebody has to be there and they usually have to take copious notes and things like, you know, those notes are subject to cross-examination even. And I don't think these are considerations that the court reached in the case, but there's a big difference between being able to interview someone, you know, on the stand, a police officer, and say, well, officer, are you sure it was this person? Did you get a good look at his face? If you're just getting in these records, I mean, if there wasn't somebody tailing him, what's to say that that person was actually driving the car at that point in time?
So, just to pose a very strange question to you guys, is there anything that you guys would consider in your own personal lives private, as insofar as like areas that you might go when you're out driving that you would not want somebody to constantly track?
I just generally wouldn't want somebody to track me constantly, but I mean, I don't think I go anywhere salacious or anything that would really damage my reputation. I mean, maybe my improv theater, but other than that.
To post a sort of reverse hypothetical, say that this say that this guy in this case, this actually turns out to be a drug case, but say that he had been using one of those location update services like Twitter or Foursquare to say, hey, meeting with my buddies and that sort of thing, and the court had used that as evidence to tie him together, say that all these drug dealers are using Foursquare checking in at the drug dealing spot. Ooh, I'm the mayor of this spot. That sort of thing. Like, if it's something that they're volunteering information-wise, then that is fine, right?
Yeah, I would think that would be perfectly all right because then there's absolutely no search that's going on. That's freely available information that these people are clearly and very intentionally making public. That's a very different case than somebody attaching a GPS tracker to your car. Or at least I think it's a very different can of beans.
I do agree. I mean, obviously the use of technology in this case is much more, you're getting much more comprehensive data than you would if you just did this with a person, you know, if a person just trailed a guy. But I was just trying to spin this a little bit and put this concept that we had, the legal concept of privacy, into practice, if you will, and try to see if we had a consensus on anything that might be that you might find to be a violation of your own privacy rights.
Right. From the best that I can remember, or at least from what's been widely reported, I know somebody once used a Facebook update based on where they made the update, tracking IP addresses to prove that they did not commit a specific crime. I don't think, at least I haven't heard any news about somebody who's been convicted of a crime in whole or in part of location-based information posted on any type of social network. There have been cases of people posting like just robbed a bank on Facebook and then getting nabbed, but that's not location-based information. You know,
So,
I don't know of anyone who checked into Foursquare right before knocking over a liquor store.
yeah, that's a really good point, and that's we are mostly talking about location information and not too much more than that, at least as far as I can tell. Because if you had somebody that was trailing a suspect in a car and they parked wherever the guy parked and watched him go into, say, a liquor store or something like that, you're actually seeing what a person is doing. Otherwise, if you're just tracking the GPS location of a person, then you're seeing the car pull into the lot. Okay, the car's in the lot, and at that point, they probably don't have a visual on whether the guy goes into the liquor store or whether he goes across the street to Blockbuster.
Right, and that was the point that I was trying to make with the ability to cross-examine a witness about whether or not it was that person who was driving, where they actually went in. This just gives you location information as to where the car was, not where the owner of the car or the typical driver of the car is. And I'd be surprised if this stuff weren't backed up with some sort of actual surveillance, but my guess is it was insufficient to render this the alleged constitutional error here harmless. Anything else on this story, or do we want to transition into the last story that we've got? How about David, you first? Anything?
Nope.
Dominic.
I'm happy with the decision. I am curious to see whether it'll get appealed because of the circuit split. We might see the Supreme Court rule on this, and that would be certainly very interesting because I'm not sure which way they would come down.
Yeah, it's a Fourth Amendment search and seizure things are always very difficult to tell where the Supreme Court is going to come down, because every now and then you get liberal justices siding with conservative justices and conservative justices siding with liberal justices. I really wouldn't even be able to hazard a guess, even before hearing any oral argument in this as to which way they'd come out. And obviously we'll keep tabs on this. I think the FBI would be fools not to appeal this, not to petition the Supreme Court for certiorari to hear this case. So I guess now moving into our last story. The Discovery Channel is taking Shark Week a little too far. They've decided to shut down a fan site, deadliestcatchtv.com, and we wish that you could go see the site to see what it's what's there right now, but it has been taken down since this story broke. Essentially, what this site was, it was a fan site. They had forums, and in the past, Discovery Channel, digital media, and PR people had contacted the site and offered to give them exclusives and gave them links so they could embed video on the site, things like that. And very recently, I think it was this past Monday, they got a cease and desist letter, a very, very, very nasty cease and desist letter from Discovery Channel, saying essentially all of the videos that you're embedding on your website that we've put on another website with embed codes, those are copyright infringement. Your website URL violates our intellectual property, and you should turn that over immediately, and it went on. Needless to say, the person who had previously had a very good relationship with Discovery Channel was more than a little surprised. Sadly, though, he, I guess, did not have the money to fight this and kind of rolled over and gave the Discovery Channel the URL and has shut down the site. But I mean, does this kind of thing strike you guys as fair, that his site is essentially sanctioned by Discovery Channel in the past, and then Discovery Channel turns on a dime and decides to shut it all down? David?
Well, as an initial note, I'm afraid that Discovery Channel is within their legal rights to do that if they wish, unless there's some other type of legal agreement which would bind them into some sort of time period of allowing that website to exist.
But say for, and I'm going to go into my crazy argument here, say for a second that instead of bringing, so there are two ways that Discovery Channel, if they wanted to go the lawyer up and forcibly get the URL, the domain name, they could do it through the Uniform Domain Name Resolution Policy, which everyone agrees to when they register a domain name through ICANN, which I think we're going to have to ignore that because it hurts my argument. We can get back to it later. But if they went through something like the Anti-Cybersquatting Consumer Protection Act, which is a federal statute, don't you think that there'd be some sort of latches argument that, you know, they knew that this site had been around for a certain number of years, that they've, you know, implicitly consented to this site being around with this domain name, and now they're turning around and trying to get it back? By the way, latches is basically a statute of limitations argument. So there are some things that you're not allowed to sue somebody after a certain number of years pass. Like, let's say Dave hits me with his car. After 3 years in some states, 4 years in other states, I can no longer sue him for having hit me with the car because, you know, it's too old. The idea is you want to be able to litigate these claims quickly while people's memories are fresh, while witnesses are still around, that kind of thing. Latches is a it's like a corollary to that. It's essentially saying you knew about the problem and you sat on your hands for too long, so we're not going to let you vindicate your rights anymore. So, do you think that there'd be a decent latches argument here?
What was the time frame again for how long the site had existed?
It's really, I couldn't get a firm feel of that. I know Deadliest Catch has been around for 6 years and that they have been working closely with Discovery Channel for at least two, from what I could gather.
And
So let's
I
assume,
have.
for the sake of argument, that the site had been around for 6 years and Discovery Channel knew or should have known that this website existed.
I see. Well, I don't know, because you know what, like all the reasons that you just stated that we have something called a latches defense might not apply here. Things like making sure that witnesses' memories are fresh so that they can testify about the incident. We're not really talking about that. We're talking about a website. I guess what might be unfair about this case is the fact that they're requesting the guy to transfer the domain over to them. That is something that they could, there's other legal avenues that they could go through, like the UDRP process or the ACPA way of trying to get a website. But he could have just shut down the site if he wanted to, and didn't, especially if he didn't want to pursue any kind of try to get a lawyer or something like that to fight this. But it, I don't know that you're still going to have trouble with an ongoing instance of infringement. If he's maintaining the site, adding new things, and continuously developing content on the site or linking out or embedding content, there's a tenable argument there that because of that, you have to separate, first of all, the domain portion of this threat from the actual website content, because those are really two different issues. When we're talking about the domain, it's trademark stuff, and when we're talking about the content, it's copyright for the most part, and there might be some additional trademark issues. So if we're really concerned about transferring the domain back over, you know, I don't know that the latches argument would hold as much weight, but I'll wait and hear what you guys have to say.
Dominic, you were trying to chime in a second ago.
Yeah, I think it would. Like, they. All right, so the show's name is Deadliest Catch. The website's name is deadliestcatchtv.com. On the face of this, yes, this is trademark. This is a trademark issue, but the Discovery Channel linked to the site from their own official webpage, and they didn't just link to it, but they used frames to display the guy's site inside their webpage. They've definitely been aware of this site. They've supported this site. They knew about the domain name right away. They didn't do anything for at least a year, it seems like, if not more. And then suddenly, out of the blue, they turn around and say, "Hey, they don't even say anything nicely. They just send a nasty gram and be like, 'Yo, take down your site. You're infringing our trademark.'" Like, you, that's just not right. You just,
You know what? It sounds like there might be facts here that we just don't know about. Business relationships go south all the time, and they're not always like pecuniary relationships, meaning that there's no transfer of money between the parties. This could have just been like a mutually beneficial agreement that the Discovery Channel had with the owner of the website. And for whatever reason, the relationship fell apart, and they decided that they no longer wanted to support him in whatever way that they were supporting him. And unfortunately, you know, that's what happens sometimes. And when that does happen, you sometimes see companies who will aggressively protect their IP.
Yeah, I mean that I agree, and we're doing a lot of speculation on our end here. But from what I've read, that doesn't seem to be the point. That doesn't seem to be not the point. That doesn't seem to be what happened here. There was just a very good relationship out of the blue, without any communication as to what was going wrong, if anything was going wrong. You know, maybe there was just a change in intellectual property policy at Discovery Channel that made them, you know, flip on a dime and decide to enforce their IP against this person. If you guys are okay with the domain name, I do want to talk about embedding. I personally do not think that embedding a file for which an embed code had been enabled can ever constitute copyright
I
infringement.
agree.
David?
I mostly agree. This is such a tortured concept for me, because it could be the case that oh, and this might not be the case here, by the way, but it could be the case that a company who produces content and offers it for viewing on its website and also gives out the embed code also has a terms of service agreement which functions as a contract, and within the terms of service agreement, they reserve the express right to request other people not to embed it on their websites. And for me, this is so difficult to resolve because when you have an instance like that, you've got contract rights and you've got copyright rights that are there, including fair use rights, and these all play a very important role. So it comes down to a case-by-case basis for me, and it depends on what the nature of the use is. So looking at this particular instance here, and I never saw the website, so I'm going to speculate a little bit, but if the guy was making money off the website in some way, if there was advertising, and if he was essentially profiting off of embedding the Discovery Channel content on his website, and you did have a terms of service agreement which did reserve those rights, or, you know, at least provide some sort of instances where the company can go in and request that somebody take down an embedded video posting, then you might have an instance where this is okay to request somebody, it's within the bounds of reasonable law to request somebody to take it down. Other than that, you know, I think you also got the fair use defense to think about, but in many cases, contract rights like a terms of service agreement will override fair use rights, and we haven't seen a whole lot of courts be terribly friendly to the concept that fair use is something that can never be taken away as some sort of like an inalienable right to the Copyright Act. But anyhow, it all comes down to the facts in the case. So if you guys have any additional facts, please enlighten me.
I'm tapped out. The coverage of this was kind of spotty, largely because I think the proprietor of the site was kind of spooked by what had happened, and I think wisely decided to divulge not a lot of information about it. I mean, obviously we would have preferred if he, you know, spilt everything that he knew, but he did not. So I think I'm tapped out for facts, unless Dominic knows something.
He did release the email that he got from someone at the Discovery Channel, giving them basically, "Hi, I work at the Discovery Channel. I'm writing you to offer you free preview content and assets from the new season of Deadliest Catch. We feel the show is a great fit with your site, especially readers, and we'd love to get the word out about some new exciting catch initiatives this season. I've included the official press release, high-quality preview videos, exclusive photography, brief episode descriptions, and much more. I'll be happy to act as your point of contact. Let me know if there's anything more we can provide you with." Like, and this is from a Discovery guy who, incidentally, no longer works at the company. It's just such a reversal. Allegedly, one of the lawyers that the guy who runs the site talked to said that they've changed their mind on the allowing on their fan site policy. But there's screenshots of the official Deadliest Catch website with a fan site link with Deadliest Catch TV listed there. Other sites, one called DeadliestCatch.com, which is another trademark violation. I wonder if that's been taken down. I want to say that something akin to latches has to apply here, because you can't just they've got to have waived some sort of right. Like, it just, I'm not sure on the specifics, but it feels like there has to be something in the law that would.
Well, what? So now, from what I'm getting out of you, it sounds like the relationship was much more developed, and there might not have been like a physical contract, meaning either a written one or one that was, you know, attached to an email with signatures on it between these two parties, but you might have an argument that emails sent back and forth like that do constitute binding legal agreements, at least to some extent, and that would sort of authorize him to embed at least the videos which were discussed within the email that he got, or any other emails that he got, as long as they include a similar language. So that's a much different question than I was just thinking about, of whether if a content producer like Discovery Channel offers videos on their website and also includes the embed code, is that like a wholesale authorization to post it on all the websites out there? So in that case, as you just stated, Dominic, you know, I think it's much different, and I think you actually have some real contract issues there, and it sounds like there was authorization, but again, it's the facts are a little murky. The guy doesn't work there anymore. You know, I don't know what that means, and it's not really clear if we have all of the emails. You know, even, you know, you never know what else might have gone on behind the scenes with the two parties. So
sure, but I was saying that with regard to the trademark issue, like in terms of their awareness, they were clearly aware of the issue because they were emailing the site. And they didn't do anything for a long enough amount of time. As for the embedding videos, if we embed a video from Deadliest Catch from their YouTube channel on Technically Legal, according to Discovery Channel's lawyers, they would send us a takedown notice for copyright infringement, which I think doesn't make any sense at all.
I agree. So, if do you want to chime in with something, David?
I think enough has been said here, but yeah, I do think it depends on the circumstances. I am pretty certain that this is going to be an issue that will be discussed a lot in the future, this concept of whether or not you can just post or embed videos from other people's websites and how much you can actually control that. Very interesting legal questions there, so.
Okay. In that case, I'd like to thank you all for tuning in to listen to this, the 63rd episode of the Technically Legal Podcast. Signing off, I'm Ben Snitkoff.
I'm Dominic Rabier.
And I'm David O'Brien.
As always, you can visit us on our website, www.technicallylegal.org, email us with suggestions, podcast@technicallylegal.org, or follow us on Twitter, @TechLegal. Thanks for stopping by.